that robot voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
CLC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're strolling outside in that brisk November air. Maybe you're bundled up in a scarf and a coat, walking through with us in your ear holes, where we're going to be with you in those ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free, thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. They bring the show to you, their support, their generosity, their belief in what we're doing here. Boy, it means a lot to us. It means you get to listen to this show. And it also means that those patrons get some cool perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a bunch of bonus content. You got the Feeling This on Fridays, Feeling This Fridays with Christian Spicer and Alex Soman talking about the feelings behind video games. You got Wednesday, Paid DLC, where Lana Bashinsky joins Christian Spicer and myself to talk about all the wacky stuff that you're talking about, the patrons are talking about. This last week, we had a AMA, Ask Me Anything type deal. Atlanta was still traveling. We had Danish Syed come and join us. So much fun. That show is always a blast. Check it out. Become a patron. Patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, the spell of two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who's rocking the stash. Well, one of two guys rocking a stash. Mr. Christian Spicer! Hello, Christian!
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everyone. It's like cold, you know, a little bit. So it's like
time just on the bottom of your face, though, not on the top.
No, I'm growing that out too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But the chin is my hot point. You know, I got to keep that kind of trimmed up. I got to keep it just that upper lip gets so chilly, you know?
Sure. Yeah. You got warm chin, cold lip syndrome. I know that. I know how
you've
that
heard
is.
Of it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Well, we got more than one stash on this show, ladies and gentlemen. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I am so excited because once again, DLC stands for Disney Licks and Clutter, because we have the co-host of 90s Disney, Last of the Nintendogs, and Game Mess Decides, as well as managing editor of Games Beat, our friend Mike Minotti is back with us. Hey, Mike!
Hello! Thank you for having me back. I am part of the problem. I'm already listening to Christmas music. Oh, no!
Is it too soon? Is it right? Just right? What do you guys think? Are we... I feel... My wife is ready. She's ready to like transform our whole house. I was like, let's slow our roll slightly.
It's objectively too soon, and yet I'm enjoying it anyways. I didn't decide it. I went outside, and it was like cold, and I went in my car, and the radio station just was already doing it. And at first, I'm like, well, that's pretty early. And then like 10 seconds later, I was like, jingle bells, yeah. Happy feelings. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to roll with it.
You know, this week I think we can all use a little joy, a little comfort music. But whatever it takes is what I say.
The radio's got two seasons. It's got school's out for summer, and then it's got Christmas, and that's it. Right. That's all you're gonna. It's one of the two. You know,
that's exactly right.
Hey, we got a lot of video games to talk about this week. Some interesting news and some big releases. So let's jump right in. Start the show the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. That's also where you can send comments, questions, suggestions, anything. You can just send it right into us. It's amazing. You type it, you send it, we get it. dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also visit our Discord, which is 5x5DLC on Discord, where there's also other folks hanging out, talking about video games and all sorts of other cool stuff. Check it out. Become part of the community. That's 5x5DLC on Discord. But Mike, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Yeah, I'm pretty interested in this Nintendo Switch stuff. I mean, it's, you know, doing a Nintendo podcast every week, right? This slow drip of Nintendo Switch 2 news, more often than not rumors, it can be a bit painful. So having Nintendo actually say something concrete about the Switch successor, as they call it right now, confirming that it will have backward compatibility of some kind seems like pretty full stuff there. So knowing that that's coming at least is nice. I know there was always kind of not rumors or information swirling around there that, hey, doing backwards compatibility on the next Switch is going to be harder than you think because it's going to be a bit of a different infrastructure. There's some different chips. You know, I'm not a super hardware guy. I didn't quite understand, but I would kind of like listen and nod. I'd be like, I bet it's going to be pretty hard. They better figure it out anyways, though, because, right? Like, I'm not buying all of those games again. I don't want to lose that entire Switch library. And I think Nintendo understood that. This day and age, you can't expect people to start over from scratch. On the Xbox and PlayStation side, they've had that figured out for a little bit now. We kind of have our forever libraries on these platforms now. So that stuff just has to carry on going forward now.
Yeah, and I think I think it's a smart choice. It's the first time Nintendo has done this and stated that that's a goal with one of their new generational systems. I guess the Game Boy kind of had it.
The Wii could do GameCube and the Wii you could do Wii, but it was always because those systems just had those systems inside of it, right? Like,
right.
That's how it worked.
One of them. Yeah.
Right. It was like how that one PS3 could play PS2 and PS1 games. Well, it just like had those components inside of it.
Yeah.
This is being done on a presumably more of a software level, or maybe it is. Once again, they just threw a Switch chip in there. We don't really know exactly what the solution is.
I guess you're right. Wii U is the big exception there. I should have remembered. But my question to you about this, Mike, I honestly do think this is a good thing to announce. It's an odd time. It's like, we're not talking about the successor, but we will tell you this tidbit. I wonder if you have an explanation as to why that would be. But before we even get there, my big question, I think, in hearing Switch backwards compatibility is a key feature of this next console, whatever it will be called, is, do you think that holds back the potential for Nintendo to innovate? If we are now in this place where the expectation is the previous generation will work on the new generation. You know, I think Nintendo, more than any other console manufacturer, has done some really interesting, weird stuff in the past with their consoles. And I kind of, you know, as many misses as they've had from my perspective, there's been a whole bunch of great hits as far as pushing the industry forward into weird things, you know, the Wiimote and you know, the C-Stick, and the list goes on and on and on of how they've innovated by putting out new consoles. Do you think that that era is over just by necessity of having this feature going forward?
Not necessarily. So I think sometimes Nintendo would force that innovation in the hardware, and that's how you would get things like the Wii with all the waggle and the 3DS with the 3D screen and kind of forcing it on the Wii U. I think what they learned with the Switch is that maybe you can make the hardware kind of basic in some ways. You throw your gimmicks on there, but you could do the innovation on the software level, right? You know, Breath of the Wild, right? This huge, super innovative game. So many people are influenced by that. That's a Wii U game, really.
Yeah, right.
We all played it on the Switch. And then much later, we got Tears of the Kingdom, which, again, doing a lot of its own innovations. And that's just on a software level. It's not because of the inherent hardware gimmicks of the Switch that's able to innovate. I think Nintendo understands that now. So yeah, they're going to play it very safe on what the Switch 2 is. It's going to look a lot like a Switch. It's probably just going to be a more powerful Switch. But I hope that they still continue to be creative and innovative with the way they're handling games. We're seeing some of that even with that, you know, that test they were doing for some kind of MMO thing that people aren't really allowed to talk about. But they're doing, you know, Nintendo's working on an MMO of some kind. Well, that's interesting. And of course, they're going to have a completely different approach and idea of what that should be than other people. So I think it's just a good thing, right? We're going to come to this new system. You're going to already have access to this entire old library of games. You're going to have NSO and those old games from the consoles like NES and SNES. You'll still have all of that too, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to hamper their creativity or anything.
What do you think, Christian? I'm heartened. A lot of what makes the Nintendo, especially first party stuff, so special is their art direction, the way that they make that very old hardware now, the Switch, you know, old hardware, still shine and look competitive with other contemporary video games. For example, you know, Echoes of Wisdom, I think, is a lovely looking game. It doesn't seem outdated because it is stylized and the art direction enhances what, you know, Switch is able to do and makes it seem like a choice, which of course it is. So I love the fact that the backwards compatibility is going to move forward into the new console. And I think these games will still feel contemporary on the new system. Do you think there needs to be some added flair? Do we need to see a glow up of these games on the new system, or is backwards compatibility enough of a feature for you?
I mean, I almost feel like the way Nintendo is announcing this, they're going to come at us on December, like December 10th, and be like, we're ready to talk about our next console. And it's just still the Switch, you know, like it's all just been like, your Switch games will work on our next console, the Switch. Wait, what? There's no, this one has better speakers, the better kickstand. Oh no, they did it. Nintendo got us. We're going to micro LED screen for, oh no. I would love for there to be some version of what Xbox did with their old games, right? Like you just on the Series X, you play an old Xbox game and some of them are boosted. Not all of them, but a pretty good collection of their old games got 4K sharpening and, you know, stuff that was happening on the hardware side or that the hardware was able to provide for these games that required nothing for the user. I would love Echoes of Wisdom. It's a fantastic game. I have a feeling we'll be talking about it at the end of the year. But it chugs in places, not in a way that I think ruined the gameplay experience, but it chugs in places. And I would love to see the next console not have that problem with that game. Kind of like I bought Elden Ring. I bought the PS4 version of Elden Ring to play on my PlayStation 5 because at the time that was the only version that you could get a stable 60 frames per second. I was playing the PS4 version of the game on PS5. And so I'd love it if it was able to do something like that. And I think there's a decent enough chance that some games, not all, but some games will support something like that, whether it's because of an NVIDIA partnership and an AI and you know what they're able to do there with things like FSR for AMD and DLSS for NVIDIA, like all of that tech, I could see it being applied, or PSSR in PlayStation 5 Pro now, kind of giving those games an automatic little bit of a zhuzh. What I find more interesting, or equally interesting, Jeff, and I'll kick back to you with this. The data shows time and time and time and time and time again, folks don't play their old games on their new consoles. So is this just we're hungry for Nintendo news? Is this much ado about nothing? Or do you think we are in an era now, as Mike pointed out, where console manufacturers are getting into this kind of forever library, where maybe it really does matter this time around? It really, really does.
I think the massive install base of the Switch and the continued huge games that are coming out on Switch up until evidently we're hearing about this next one, which, you know, who knows, the next few months. But I think that heartens people to feel like, hey, yeah, I shouldn't wait to buy Echoes of Wisdom or whatever the game, the Mario Luigi game. I shouldn't wait till the next console comes out. It's all going to work. It's all going to be great. I think that's it's a reassurance that makes people feel like, oh, the system I'm working on now, if I'm going to buy more software for it, I'm not throwing it down a hole that I'm not going to want to touch ever again. You know, I think it's more about that, frankly. And I do think people want, even if they don't take advantage of it, I think they want the idea that we're not closing a door on all this stuff that I like. The door is still open. Even if maybe I don't walk through that door very often, it's not closed. So I suspect that this is a big deal to people, even if they don't take advantage of it as much as they think they might. What's your take, Mike?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, whether people use it or not, they're going to feel comfortable just knowing that it's all there. Yeah. And if there is some kind of a boost to those old games, and, you know, people were saying that supposedly Nintendo behind closed doors at Gamescom or GDC or something, like the demo that they were showing to developers to give them an idea to switch to was just Breath of the Wild running at, you know, like 4K and 60 FPS. Now, is it just going to automatically do that? Is it going to be kind of like what we see PlayStation do, where it's like, hey, you own that game, now give us $10 and you'll get the kind of boosted version of that, right? Which that sounds a little bit more Nintendo to me than maybe what Xbox did, where it was just all these games are going to, you know, magically look better. I bet there'll be maybe a bit of a price increase for a select few of them to get a little bit of that juice. But, you know, people happily pay that to go back to, you know, Tears of the Kingdom, Breath of the Wild, some of these games that were amazing but weren't running at 60 frames per second and maybe didn't have the crispest image. I don't know if there's anything you can do for Pokemon Scarlet and Violet to help that one out, but there's plenty of games that could benefit from it.
I wonder, you know, Nintendo has made so much money off of these generational updates to things like Mario Kart, Super Smash Brothers. I wonder if that impedes that in any sense, that, you know, it could be backwards compatible to your old Mario Kart. I guess perhaps it incentivizes them to push those series in different directions to differentiate them even more from something you can still play. Like, I have a hard time imagining a Smash Brothers that's like, where do they go with that game now? It's like we did all of it.
I'm a big Smash Brothers fan, and I often wonder, like, Mario Kart can play basically the Smash Brothers Kart card, right? They can just throw in a lot more characters from outside of Mario and whatnot. Yeah. Like, this Smash Brothers had everything. It was the whole tagline. Everybody's here, has all this content. Like, if you make a new one of those, can you get all those characters in there again? It might even just be a logistics nightmare because of all the contracts and third-party people. Yeah. So what do? Do you finally make a 3D fighting game? Well, a lot of the traditionalists may not like that. But yeah, it is weird because if you just have backwards compatible Super Smash Brothers Ultimate, God, that might be good enough for a lot of people. Maybe you just do another Fighter's Pass or something like that. Yeah, it's weird because there's going to be another Smash Brothers because the game sold like 30 million copies. They're going to have to do something.
Right.
It's hard to figure out what, though.
It is. It's such an interesting conundrum. But, you know, nobody innovates better than Nintendo, so we'll see. I'm heartened, and I think we're going to hear about. Do you have a prediction, Mike, as to when we'll hear an actual Switch successor announcement?
It threw me off that it didn't happen by the end of October, so I kind of like am despairing a bit. I'm like, I don't know. Like, we know it's going to be before the end of the fiscal year, which is March 31st. They said that. It is a little bit now, like, maybe it is. We don't hear about it till January. I don't think they do it at the Game Awards. They could do whatever they want to, but I imagine they'll do it themselves. But they want to do it in December. They got to do it kind of earlier before all the holiday stuff, right? Because you don't want to kind of do it in that miasma. Anything. Exactly. Right. It gets kind of lost. So I don't know. I'm almost beginning to feel like January might make sense, but Nintendo, it could be tomorrow. Who knows?
Yeah. My money is on after the first of the year, but we'll see. We'll see. We'll be here waiting to find out. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
My story of the week is a story that several years ago I would have been like, that's going to be terrible. And now, with it happening now, I am like, I am so dang excited for this. I'm more excited for this than I am for the next game in the series. And that is, there is a Variety posted an exclusive that a Mass Effect TV series is in the works at Amazon. Daniel Casey is going to write and executive produce. He wrote Fast and the Furious 9, which I say this, I think on last week's show, I talked about the Nintendo Switch Online music app and me honestly liking it. Fast 9 is a good time.
Is that the one where they go to space?
Is that not 8 or 9?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's so good. What happened?
No, I think 9 they're, is they're the all space good one. Up until 10. 10 poops in the toilet. But like 6, 7, 8, 9, good times. Good times.
Yeah, I loved mean, I don't, and I wouldn't use the Fast movies as your benchmark for great writing, but you know.
But good times. Also, I wanted to say, hey, do you know who's going to make a movie that's going to win Joaquin Phoenix his Best Actor Award? The guy from The Hangover. That's the guy who's going to do it. Right. You know, like people can work outside genres they've done before. What I'm mostly excited about for this is Fallout is incredible. Absolutely incredible. Amazon, you know, backed up the truck for that financial wise to make it look great. Rings of Power looks better than I think almost anything in Lord of the Rings has ever looked, like just the production value in that TV show. Yeah. It looks like $1 billion. And I think Mass Effect done well, in my head, it would be Apple TV Plus and kind of, you know, the silo, like their sci-fi approach to things usually look really, really good. And now Amazon and Prime Video. And so I'm super excited for this. The Andromeda, I didn't love the last game. I'm not a huge, huge, huge Mass Effect fan in terms of the games. They're not my favorite series. I know they are to a lot of folks. But it is a world ripe for a TV show, whether it retells the story of the original trilogy or just talks about any of the other lore in those games. I'm super excited for this. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, certainly visually, it has a visual language that I think will be really wonderful to see live action. I think that all of the, you know, all of the aesthetics of Mass Effect are really, really cool and can make for some awesome TV. Mike, I'm curious, Christian kind of brought this up at the end. Do you think, what would you prefer to see? A story that features Shepard and stars all the characters that we know and you know, kind of retells that original trilogy? Or would you rather see it pushing into something unique and in its own?
I feel like normally I prefer the latter for these kind of things, and that worked out really well for Fallout. But Mass Effect seems like it's designed to just translate to TV really well. I mean, Mass Effect 2 is basically episodic, right?
Right,
like it is kind of done in chapters anyways. And so many people specifically, their love for Mass Effect is tied to their love for Shepard, for the Normandy, for Garrison, and all of those other party members. I think you probably have to go that route. I think you do just, you have your season one retelling of Mass Effect 1, season 2 Mass Effect 2, right? You do that, and that's probably going to work out well for you. I wonder if they're going to do, I mean, I guess I know what they're going to do. They're going to do male Shepard, but it's kind of interesting because they could do female Shepard.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would prefer that, but yeah, I bet we just get male Shep.
I agree. I think this is going to be closer to a Last of Us TV series than it is a Fallout TV series, honestly. I think it's probably going to be, we're taking the story of the trilogy of Mass Effect movies or show games and turn them into, as you said, seasons of TV. And I think that could be really cool. And I think these games are old enough now that that story is going to feel fresh and interesting to a whole generation of viewers.
Do you think
I don't know that that's happening for sure, but that's my guess. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm curious if you think the story resonates with folks in the same way when there is no choice. And I know Mass Effect was later maligned for there kind of being no choice. I don't have a problem with that type of game. I'm fine with it because the choice is in the moment, right? Like, tell the story you're going to tell, but those moments of what type of character you are going to be.
Yeah.
And I wonder if branching it out and doing the Fallout approach allows them to sidestep that in a way where it's, they get to be their own character in this world. And maybe Shepard is, they don't do sweeps anymore for streaming, but you know, the sweeps version of like, this episode is going to have Shepard come on. And what does that mean or something?
I think that's an interesting notion that if you dramatize a specific path through the first three games, you're somehow, you know, indicating what the preferred, you know, kind of setting in stone and removing the player agency from those games. Maybe I wonder if they even are worried about that. I mean, those games are, you know, they're not going to sell any more copies necessarily. And I guess they could remake them more. They remade only the first. No, they replayed the whole trilogy. Yeah,
they remastered the whole trilogy. Yeah, and it did well. And I wouldn't be shocked if that shows up as like an early Switch to port. I could see them doing just, you know, like I said, it's probably just going to be Mills Shepard, and it's probably going to be Paragon Mills Shepard, right? Which the safest choice is probably the most popular choice. I think some people will be like, well, I played Renegade, you know, female Shepard. This doesn't look right to me. Yeah. And I bet somebody's going to bring up that argument inside the writer's room and the board. And then someone's going to say, hey, remember the only other major Mass Effect media that doesn't have Shepard? Andromeda? Yeah, that didn't work out so well. Let's not do that.
Perhaps. I mean, I think this could be really cool. I'm genuinely excited. I prefer the Dragon Age series to the Mass Effect series personally. And have done for, you know, since they both were introduced. But I think Mass Effect will make a better live action thing than Dragon Age would. So I'm really down for this. I'm rooting for it. I think it could be really cool. Obviously, it's, you know, a ways off, years away, likely. But I'm still pretty jazzed about the notion of that, because I think some of those cool space battles and you know, all the power, the sort of Jedi-esque powers that Mass Effect was introducing. I think that stuff could all look so cool with a well-made live-action version. I'm in.
Also just the political drama. I mean, there's a world where it is very much House of Cards. You know, I would watch the Sorkin version of a Mass Effect TV show, because so much of people's favorite moments from the games are the conversations and the rich characters. I love the big space battles, and I think there's a lot of epic space combat and stuff happening in these games. But I also think spending time with those characters, just hanging out, getting to know them, what they're doing, what the political intrigue is, what is the threat, how real is the threat, how are we managing these 100 other threats, could be very compelling.
Well, we will find out. It is coming to Amazon at some point. Avi Arad is involved too. So, you know, everything he touches turns to some sort of metal.
It turns into money. That's the kind of metal money. It turns into. Yeah.
Is that the guy who's involved the Zelda movie also? Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. He's had his finger in everything since we were. He was like the guy who did the first round of comic book movies back in the day before the MCU. Yeah, he's. He's old school. He's old school. All right. Well, I have my story of the week coming up, but we're going to take a quick break first for a sponsor. We'll be right back right after this. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Green Chef. Green Chef is the number one meal kit for clean eating, delivering pre-portioned and prepped quality whole foods with limited processed ingredients. Green Chef sends organic, fresh produce, responsibly sourced proteins, and chef-designed recipes in every box for satisfying, nourishing, and convenient meals that make it easy to stick to a clean routine. Christian, you know me. You know my love of meal kits. We have switched over to Green Chef completely.
And it's probably because you can do things like 10-minute lunches, like maybe some black bean and cheese burritos. But then also when dinner time rolls around, you can have a delicious Baja California bowl. I mean, that might just be me, but I also imagine that's part of the reason for you why Green Chef has become your primary, the numero uno.
You know that saying, the old unero numero.
You know that one that they all say. But for your family, because I know that's a big reason why it's become that for our family, is not only the convenience, the options for menus, but also the ability to have a delicious lunch ready and when I want it, but then also the ability to make a delicious dinner for the whole family when we're all hungry.
That's right. You know, I love the clean eating thing. Green Chef, of course, the number one meal kit for clean eating. You can feel good about creating meals that are good for you with limited processed ingredients, which is something I really take pride in for my family. But you don't miss out on the flavor. The meals are so yummy. And every single week, you find menu options for every lifestyle, from Mediterranean meals to customizable plant-based options and certified gluten-free recipes. There are tons of options every single week. One of the things I enjoy most is picking my menu week to week and having something to look forward to, like, ooh, that's going to be yummy when it shows up. And because we've hit fall, right, the days are shorter, our to-do lists aren't getting any shorter, Green Chef can make your busy weeks easier with home delivery of step-by-step recipes and quality whole foods, including organic fresh produce in every box. And you get to taste what's in season. You got the colors and flavors of fall on the menu now. Recipes that feature fresh, seasonal organic produce like delicata squash, cranberries, Brussels sprouts, green beans, maple syrup, and pumpkin. Just sounds like fall, doesn't it? Yeah.
And also soups. You can do some soups.
There's some good soups. Oh, there's some delicious. I've had some delicious soups. You can even have a clean, feel-good Thanksgiving with all the fixins from Green Chef, featuring organic free-range turkey, stuffing, gravy, mashed potatoes, cranberry sauce, apple crumble. Ooh! And Green Chef just celebrated its 10th birthday last month. That's a decade of helping you eat more deliciously, sustainably, and nutritiously with restaurant-worthy recipes made with clean, quality ingredients. Ah, we love Green Chef. And right now, check this out. If you go to greenchef.com/DLC50 and use our promo code DLC50, you'll get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next 2 months. That's 2 months, not 2 boxes, 2 months of boxes. So that's 8 boxes potentially. That's code DLC50 at greenchef.com/DLC50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next 2 months. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well. All right. My story of the week is a follow-up, I guess you could say, on what we talked about with Take Two and Private Division. We found out this week that, you know, we had talked about the story that keeps happening in the video game industry. Almost every week we're talking about some developer being shuttered or shut down or massive firings or downsizing. Several weeks ago, we talked about Private Division, which had released some of Christian and my favorite indie games over the years, Ollie Ollie World as one and others. Now we find out that Take-Two is actually selling off Private Division, the entire label, to a mystery buyer. We don't know who that is.
Mike, is it you?
You got me. They're right out of frame over there.
Pan over. It's all a Private Division.
They're doing great. They're working on Ollie World 2 right now. It's fantastic. It'll be a huge hit for me, I hope. I put a lot of money into it.
Yes, we don't know what the sell price is, and we don't know who actually bought it, but we do know that all of the IP that Private Division had there, some games that just came out, like that Lord of the Rings farm simulator, Tales of the Shire, this mystery game from the Pokemon developer Game Freak called Project Bloom,
oh, right,
is moving over to the new owner. One game that is not acquired, one game that Take-Two is retaining rights to, is No Rest for the Wicked, which was released in early access this year, a game I raved about. Still, I'm very excited to see how it progresses through early access, but it is not part of the sale, even though it was under the Private Division label. But Mike, I'm curious if you have any guesses as to who this mystery buyer is, and if you think this is actually a saving grace for a sort of an indie label. By the way, I shouldn't laugh because it's not funny, but the quote at the end of this interview with Take-Two CEO Strauss Zelnick said, Hey, we're going to work on big stuff. We only make big stuff. We only make big games. These games are too small. It's not me who was too small. It's the pictures.
God.
What do you think, Mike? The scale of those projects was candidly on the smaller side, and we're in the business of making great big hits.
Great big hits.
Talk about Babe Ruth calling a shot. You better make some big
hits. Listen, I put my pants on just same as you, except when I do it, I make great big hits.
God. Yeah, I have no idea who's picking a Private Division. It could be anybody. Like, I worry it's just like some weird firm or something that has nothing to do with video games. I don't know. I find this whole... looking at the video game industry right now, it seems like one of the big problems, and everybody agrees, is, hey, video games have gotten too big, they take too long to make, and they're too expensive to make. That's a problem. So you think, okay, well, we need to make some more smaller games too, right? And like, people kind of gestured at doing that for a bit. Ubisoft released that great Prince of Persia game this year. EA was doing some smaller stuff for a little bit. And then everyone's like, well, wait a second. These things only make a little bit of money. We want to make a lot of money. It's like, if you make a lot of those little games, then a lot of little bits of money can be a substantial amount of money. And then they go, boring.
Where's
our live service? Something.
These games also only cost a little bit to make. They actually made a lot of money based on what they cost. Sir, can we please keep making more of them?
No, they don't like that. They don't like that.
No, you may not. Big hits.
Our return on investment was quite large.
Real quick question in the back. Big games, big hits sounds great. Big games, catastrophic failure sounds expensive and bad. Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, Ubisoft and Warner Brothers of all the major misses that they've been having lately. Now, I guess the thing with Take-Two is they're pretty confident Grand Theft Auto 6 probably gonna hit. And they're probably right, but like, that's another. Okay, so you have this giant surefire hit. Surely you can afford to release these smaller hits and at least expand your portfolio, have a few more baskets. Like, yeah, Grand Theft Auto is your big basket. I get it. That's where most of the eggs are going in. Sometimes it's nice to have like a little tiny basket to put a couple of the eggs in, just in case, heaven forbid, something happens and that big basket catches on fire, right?
Yeah,
it could happen. It probably won't. But my God, it is just, you know, full on, nothing but Grand Theft Auto. And we saw Activision just go, nothing but Call of Duty. And they had Call of Duty, biggest thing in the world. And even they were like, ooh, this isn't actually a good business. We have to sell to Microsoft. So I don't know. I don't really get this.
Ring, 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 ring.
Oh, hello. Ring. Hi. Oh, well, the studio phone is calling. Usually there's only one person on the other end of this call. Like, I suspect I know who it is. Hello?
Hi, is this Jeffrey?
No, is it Mark? Is this
Hey,
Mark?
Hey, yeah, this is Mark from marketing, and I'm here to tell you, big games, big hits. That is a tagline that I made, baby, and I would press you or your guest to come up with, a single game that had a budget in excess of $200 million that was positioned as a great live service game that maybe didn't work out. Try to name one game from the past, year, and you can't. Big games, big hits, baby.
Concord, Suicide Squad, Skull and Bones.
I'm sorry, is this guest? I was not asking about cities in the East Bay of Northern California. I'm talking about big games, big hits, babies. Have a good one, losers. Click.
Wow.
I like whenever him. Mark, he seemed nice.
Yeah, whenever Mark calls, the show gets stupider. But that's okay. I like his moxie, and I like his confidence level. You know, I think that's the exact illustration of the idea behind this. Is all we got to do is make incredibly expensive things that make incredible amounts of money, and everything is going to be great.
We just need to release a movie like Joker. Yeah. $1 billion R-rated film. Let's make another one of those. That first one was easy enough to do. What can go wrong?
Are you saying Grand Theft Auto 6 is going to be a musical?
We can only hope.
Because that'd be great, actually. Then I'd care. It'd be so legit.
GTA 6 will hit, but all the fun we're having about this story, this makes me sad. I hope the buyer isn't, you know, Embracer 2.0 or something. Like, I hope it's like someone who put some talent or money and resources into the stuff, because Private Division had hits, tons of hits, so many of my favorite games over the years. And it is in this world of, you know, people lament, what happened to the double A game? All we get are these, you know, big monstrosities. And it's like, we had these awesome Outer Worlds, you know, these compelling games that these studios were making, Annapurna, what they were making before, and their whole turnover. And my heart breaks for maybe losing this type of game. And I hope that Private Division keeps doing what they were doing, because I think they were dang good at it. And I don't want anyone at Take-Two to lose their job, certainly. That's not what I'm arguing for, but it just bums me out, because I think, Mike, you hit the nail on the head. Activision went through this 15 years ago, where every game was either Tony Hawk or Call of Duty, or Rock or Guitar Hero, and then they were like, whoopsie, those have run out, and we have no other IP.
It is a bummer. I mean, exactly what Mike illustrated, which is like all these big publishers were like, hey, we're going to do these incubator programs. We're going to make more daring, smaller titles. We're going to come out with really interesting, let creators have much longer leashes and have smaller budgets to do some outside the box stuff. And I thought it was really cool for a few years. And it just feels like all of that is contracted. All of that is gone. And we're not doing that. We don't do that anymore. We're betting huge bets on sure fire, or, you know, sure things, as close to a sure thing as we can make, which means there's less risk, less creative risk, you know. And I think that's a bummer. Thankfully, we still have a vibrant indie game scene, but it's a bummer that these larger publishers are not participating in that.
And so I think these surefire hits are going to start becoming less surefire at some point.
Well, we're seeing that, right? That's happening, right? The next Rocksteady game was as close to a surefire hit as you can imagine, and then you saw what happened.
Right.
That's just what happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's a story we're not talking about. But I guess it relates. We can bring it up here. Part of Warner Brothers investor meetings, they've talked about Multiverses, a game whose name I still think is one of the best. It's such a good – it's so good. Such
not
a
good
great
enough
game.
Christian, not good enough.
I don't think it's because of the game, because of the name, but it's underperforming. It's like $100 million hit to revenue in its game business that they're attributing to Multiverses. They acquired the studio after the game first launched on I think beta or whatever that first round was.
Yeah, they had
an
early access, and they pulled it for almost a year, and it came back, and at that point it just seemed like no one cared anymore. It was weird.
Yeah. And so this is, Warner Brothers has basically said, but they're also doing the surefire hits. Part of this an investor meeting or call or whatever it was, Zaslav said, where is it? They talk about the games they want to make, and it's Harry Potter, Batman. That's it.
Game of Thrones and
fourth
Warner Brothers thingy. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was like Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, and DC really leaning on Batman. And it's like they're also doing that. These are the things we're going to do, and that's it. And I would love more Batman games. We love this year's Batman game, Jeff, but it still feels scary.
It feels like a bummer because we're just getting the same things that we've always gotten rather than people taking a chance. And that feels less interesting overall. Not to say we don't love those things. We still love those things. But having the industry narrow its focus to so few IP is a bummer. All right. Well, we have games to talk about. Let's get to it. And talk in the segment that we like to call the playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. Mike, lots of great stuff out there this time of year. All the big hits are hitting. What has taken your time this week?
It's really been a lot of Metaphor Refund, Tazio. I've been kind of making my way through that game since it came out. I really like to take my time a bit with these Atlas joints. Like, a Persona game is usually something I play over the course of a season. It's always something I try to play on a portable, and this one I'm playing on my ROG Ally X, and it feels very nice. So go in bed, play a couple hours of that before falling asleep. I really like all those Persona games. I thought that the Persona 3 remake earlier this year was very good. But this probably trumps all of them. Really impressed with Metaphor ReFantazio. It has all that kind of high production value stuff from a Persona game that I want, that I really like. And it has the slick battle system and all that. The writing just seems ever so slightly more mature in a way I really like. And it's still fun, right? But it's taking itself a good bit seriously. Some of that is just, hey, this is mostly a group of adults and a couple of teenagers, but it's not like, oh, these are a bunch of high school students and some, you know, some of their problems are high school problems that maybe I don't necessarily care about. And of course, they're still fighting, you know, the darkness and the end of the world and all of that good jazz here. But, you know, like there's one person in my party members, like an old dad and his son died. And that's kind of the thing going on there. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's a bit more interesting than, you know, this girl who likes kung fu movies, right?
Yeah.
Like a big part of the Persona games are the social links, right? So you kind of develop these relationships with NPCs or some of your party members, and you kind of talk to them and their story progresses. And sometimes a Persona, those would be good to okay. And some of them were sort of just weird or bad. Like Persona 3 is a guy, and his whole thing is that he likes to eat a lot, and you're going to talk to him about that a lot. And it's kind of, it's very strange. All these social links hit very strongly. Again, that party member with, you know, dealing with grieving about his son is very good. It's a lot of introspective stuff like that. But gosh, it's been a good year for RPGs, especially. I've been enjoying a lot of them, but I don't think any of them are hitting quite as hard as Metaphor.
I think it's amazing. You're not the first person that we've had come on who has been a very big Persona fan, saying that Metaphor out Persona's Persona. And I think that's pretty shocking because of how much people love that series and, you know, how close it is to a lot of folks' heart. And yet this one seems to have taken a lot of what Persona does well and refined it and, you know, topped it. At least that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah,
as somebody who's not in that category.
But what's also nice is, you know, and in a lot of ways, yeah, it's fantasy Persona, but in a lot of ways it isn't. It's less that than you would think. They do shake things up in the right way. Even the format, even though there is still a bit of that calendar system, which is such a big part of Persona, but it feels very different here. And it's not quite as rigid in the schedule, the things that you're doing. The battle system is a bit different. You're still kind of exploiting enemy weaknesses to get extra turns, but it sort of formulates itself differently. It's really neat how you kind of walk around these dungeons where you do kind of have action combat controls where you can't just swing a sword and hit people, and you want to hit them and get your attacks in and dodge their attacks so you have an advantage when the actual turn-based combat starts. So just adding these little flares here and there make it really interesting.
Do you think that Metaphor ReFantazio could win someone over that hasn't enjoyed Persona before, or do you think it's too close to be that?
Maybe, because I think a lot of people don't like Persona, just don't like JRPGs, maybe, right?
Mm-hmm.
I get it. It's a very special flavor sometimes. So I don't know. That might be a tall order. There's going to be some people, sure, who, again, maybe don't like the kind of, you know, high school teenager vibe of the Persona games. And this one being a bit more fantasy and focusing a bit more on adults and its themes being a bit more like one of the big things going on here is, oh, hey, look, it's kind of a medieval society with kings. And all of a sudden, they're forced to have an election. So they're dealing with a democracy and everybody's all confused and scared. It's really interesting. It takes a little bit to get there. And if you're somebody who, you know, the idea of spending 5 hours getting established in a world, getting established with a game sounds kind of painful to you, then it still might not be for you.
Christian, I feel like this could be your jam.
I'm certain it is. And I just haven't found the time for it yet. I know it's such a big game,
yeah,
that I don't want to start it and start to fall in love with the world and then have to move on, not have to, but move on for something else because there's something else that, you know, catches my fancy and I want to play. But everything I've heard about it it seems incredible. I was giggling a little bit to myself, Mike, thinking about this as like a bedtime game where I like Persona, that makes sense to me, but I've heard this story. I don't know if mature is the right word, but like political intrigue and, yeah, you know, all this stuff. I could be like, ah, time to go to bed with this gut-wrenching episode of The West Wing. Oh no, I made a terrible mistake. Yeah.
But that's why what I really use when I fall asleep is some kind of boring, like, science-based audiobook, right? So I do this, and I get one of those going, and then I usually drift away at some point.
Yeah, that checks out. But I mean, no one does style the way these games do style. I think even just in their menus, they released, I forget if it was like a vid doc or how it came out, but like the how excruciatingly painful it is to make these stylistic menus that we all just kind of take for granted. But I think for me, kind of a big takeaway from this and all the Persona games is trying to realize here in the moment that we are living through the golden age of BioWare, the golden age of Square, the golden age, like all these monster RPG franchises and studios that we've had in the past. This is Sega Atlas doing it right now. And sometimes I think it's hard to recognize that while you're in it. Like, oh, my next door neighbor is Leonardo da Vinci. I live in the most amazing time for Renaissance artists. And I think this is it. And I think this is them only, kind of proving it, like doing something outside of Persona.
If only they had named one of their games Golden, so we could have known.
I get it. Okay. That was bad.
Okay.
No, it's okay. I'll give it to you.
You groaned. I'll get it.
It was a bemused groan. It was bemusement. Bemusement, we'll say. But you know, gosh, Sega in general, what a year that they've been having, really. Because, you know, they had this. They had the Persona 3 remake. Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth was really popular with a lot of people. They even made a good Sonic game. Sonic Shadow Generations, that's actually a lot of fun. One of the few years ever, I think you could say, Sega, I think they had a better year than Nintendo. That's wild. So, yeah, you're right. Yeah. But Atlas is just absolutely showing, oh, yeah, they are very, very good at this. They definitely have some momentum behind them. It's also, as a big JRPG fan, I love seeing them succeed and still be innovative and interesting with turn-based combat. I'm not somebody who gets really mad when a Final Fantasy isn't turn-based, but I do roll my eyes when they make those decisions like, oh, it has to be an action game because nobody likes turn-based anymore. And then Metaphor comes out and sells millions of copies. And you know, right?
Baldur's Gate.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. I'm like, no, yeah. I don't think that's true. I don't know why you think that necessarily, but that's not really true. You know, Final Fantasy 16 is what it is. And I kind of hope in the future maybe Square Enix will feel a bit more comfortable maybe going back to the roots a little bit.
Well, that's Metaphor Refantasio, which I just really enjoy saying.
Sure.
So that's always I always like talking about it just so I can say Refantasio.
Yeah, you kind of feel like you're like an opera conductor or something.
Yeah, yeah. I like leaning into it. Christian Spicer, what's on your playlist?
Would it surprise anyone? I guess it surprises some people that it's been this long, but would it surprise anyone to know that I'm here to talk about Alan Wake? More Alan Wake. Alan Wake 2, The Lake House, which is the second expansion for the Collector's Deluxe Edition. I forget what they called it. The more expensive edition of Alan Wake 2. It is the only way to get this expansion. They don't sell it standalone, but it is the second expansion.
Yet.
I mean, I hope so, because it's incredible and more people should play it, give people access to it. So currently, here we are. Here I am talking about Alan Wake 2, The Lake House, right before the Switch 2 was announced. You know, so I just got to hedge all my bets. Currently, only available as part of the Deluxe Edition. This expansion is absolutely incredible, Christian says, surprising no one. But I just remain so blown away with what Remedy does and is able to do in how they craft their worlds. So this expansion took me a little over 3 hours to finish it from start to finish. I played it in one day. I was like, oh, I should start The Lake House. I haven't played this and I should really play this. And then I was like, I'm not getting up except to go to the bathroom. Then I'm going to play more Lake House. And I won't give anything away substantively in terms of the narrative, but it is very much an Alan Wake 2 game, that being the controls, the camera. Yes, the kind of, you know, jump scares and stuff like that. It is still the Alan Wake 2 world and how you control your character. You're playing as FBC agent Estevez, who you meet in Alan Wake 2 proper. As I open up my notes to check that it didn't say something that I don't want to talk about. There's a reveal in it. I didn't want to mention it. But the way it brings, so in Alan Wake 2 controls in that scheme, in that perspective, but it brings you into the control aesthetic in a really cool way. In Alan Wake 2, you know that the Lake House is an FBC, Federal Bureau of Control center. And so they're able to bring you into this world that has rooms and areas and environments that look like the stuff you'd see in Control. I absolutely love that aesthetic that they did in Control, this kind of 70s retro futurism world where there's still, you know, the camcorder with the big VHS tape and a big rotary phone, but also some sci-fi tech that we don't have in our world and stuff like that. And so seeing those environments in Alan Wake 2, as someone who's a huge fan of Control and a huge fan of Alan Wake, it really felt like, you know, the crossover cartoon episodes you get as a kid where like the Transformers meet G.I. Joe and they're like, they're putting my two favorite things together.
Scooby-Doo and the Globetrotters.
Yes, yes. They're doing the thing. And I know there's already a shared universe and they alluded to it, but now I'm seeing it in the thing and it just feels so good. And the way that they fill their world with story in terms of placement and environment, I don't know if there's a studio who builds these 3D worlds with more purpose than what Remedy does right now. Like the way every desk is positioned, everything in all of the environments you go into just feels so purposeful in setting the stage and the tone and the story that they're trying to tell. And there is some really, really cool narrative stuff that happens in Alan Wake 2 expansion, The Lake House as well, further connecting these two stories of Alan Wake and the Federal Bureau of Control. And on top of that, it plays fantastic. It is still, you know, the Alan Wake style of third-person combat and using your flashlight and using your weapons. But the way it just is covered in atmosphere is absolutely incredible, and the performances are great. Man, I don't think many people are playing it, unfortunately, because I haven't heard a lot of chatter about it online, and it's currently only available through the more expensive version of the game. But it is an absolute home run. If you liked Alan Wake 2 at all, I highly recommend upgrading to this expanded edition to get both of these expansions. 100% top tier quality, top to bottom, and a really, really cool story. If I had to pick between this or the prior expansion, I think The Lake House is the better of the two. The earlier expansion had some really, really, really awesome moments, but it also had a few subchapters in it that were a little flatter than the rest. And Lake House, top to bottom, is just top tier Remedy doing what they do best. Really incredible.
There you go. Alan Wake 2, The Lake House.
It's a lake. Bam,
bam, bam. I should check it out. I did like Alan Wake 2 a lot. I haven't tried this or the previous DLC yet. There's always so much pressure coming up on Game of the Year time, and some publications I'm part of, they're doing Game of the Year in like early December, so I'm trying to get through some of the stuff from this year. So even things that are, you know, expansions for games, you know, they're new expansions and they totally are important for this year. It's like, yeah, that's important, but ooh, I better really beat Metaphor and Brothership is out, and you know, I feel bad that I haven't played Infinite Wealth and whatnot, but at some point I need to get to this.
Yeah, and it's there for you. I love that it's a standalone 3-hour experience, which I think is great. It works best having finished Alan Wake 2, certainly, but it's not something that a year from now will be bad, you know, because you didn't get to it.
Yeah, I can see myself probably, I wouldn't be shocked if it's like, oh, Control 2 is coming out next month. I never did go play those Alan Wake 2 DLC chapters. I'll go do that now.
Yeah. Yeah, they're at the top of their game. And also, all the DLSS stuff, it's still just absolutely beautiful with what they're able to do graphically with all of the zhuzhing that's happening as well with the full ray tracing. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
Well, that's on Christian's playlist, Alan Wake 2, The Lake House. Let's take another quick break for a sponsor. We'll be right back right after this. All right, my playlist. I was gone all weekend. I'll talk about that in a moment. But I did have an early code for a game I've been playing for a while now called Metal Slug Tactics. This is the Tactics version of the old classic Neo Geo franchise Metal Slug. I love Tactics games. I have a lot of wonderful nostalgia for Metal Slug. But would those two properties, those two concepts, combine well? Well, it turns out yes. The answer is yes. I am so impressed with this game. First of all, visually, I just absolutely love how this game looks. It is channeling the old Neo Geo sprite look, you know, pixel sprite look of Metal Slug.
Metal Gear.
And the sort of high quality that Neo Geo always had, the lots of animation in the sprites, lots of detail in the world. And now we've taken the Metal Slug, which was, you know, a 2D side-scrolling run-and-gun action game, and built it into a isometric environment that's much more a tactics game. I mean, it is a tactics game, but much more, you know, has to accomplish the look of an isometric world. And it still really, really works. I love the look and feel of this game. It evokes Metal Gear. Keep doing that. It evokes Metal Slug, but does it, it also feels fresh and cool and looks just sharp, beautiful, alive in all the ways that Metal Slug used to. And I was so dazzled by a Neo Geo game back in the day because it just
had
such a high level of artistry just visually.
Can I ask you, so what kind of tactics game would you compare this to most? Is it like Final Fantasy Tactics? Is it kind of Advanced Warsy or Fire Emblem?
I mean, it's a little Advanced Warsy, but the thing that is so cool about Metal Slug Tactics is that it really brings something fresh to the table that I've never seen before. And I think the signature quality of this game is that it is something it lifts from its source material. Metal Slug, traditionally, and all its sequels, are run-and-gun games. You are moving. You got to keep going and shooting and blast everything on the screen and keep going and don't stop. Well, that's not really how you or I should say, not really how I tend to play tactics games. I'm turtling. I'm staying in one spot. I found good cover. I put my units over here and over here and over here so that I can best dominate the battlefield, but I'm not moving them around a lot necessarily unless I have to. Well, Metal Slug Tactics says a core mechanic of how you stay alive is tied to how much you move on your turn. So you moving a character through space generates adrenaline, which is tied to their block and dodge. So you are highly incentivized to move a lot each time you move a character. And once you shoot with either your primary or secondary weapon, you can't move again. So it's like, hey, you got to plan out, move around. Add to that this really cool system where you can get cover any adjacent space to cover. So you don't have to be behind cover. You can just be next to it. Kind of doesn't make sense sometimes that you have cover and the guy's standing right next to you, but that's the way it works.
Video games.
But also, you have these traits on all of your little characters that can, they have passive traits that will proc when certain conditions happen. Like if you are standing in a certain configuration with an enemy that you are attacking with one character, the other character will automatically attack. So you get like bonus attacks. And so you can sort of trigger this fun domino effect by all the placement of the characters. But that's made more tricky by the fact that everybody's trying to move on their turn as much as possible before they shoot. So it really generates its own feel. It's a different question than most tactics ask of the player. It's a different set of parameters that you're trying to accomplish, which is like move, get to cover, but also end your positions in such a way that will cause this domino effect to trigger and maximize the amount of times that all your characters get to attack. Add to that the fact that this is a roguelite, and so you're doing different runs and upgrading abilities, and some of the upgrades are really cool and create some really interesting dynamics as you move forward, where you get other kind of cool bonuses or things can happen based on, you know, putting yourself in a very specific position relative to the enemy, so that you're constantly being, your upgrade path is constantly reinforcing that notion of like, of positioning, of being conscious of how to make these certain features proc in the characters that you have. It really, I think it adds a layer of run and gun, which is what the Metal Slug franchise has always been about, that I don't usually play these games with. And I think that is pretty cool. I'm really digging Metal Slug Tactics a lot.
Yeah, that sounds neat. I do kind of like how it sounds like they found a way to make Tactics a bit more interesting and give it a little bit of a flair by going into what that, you know, the base franchise is about. Although yeah. For me, the big draw here still would just be that pixel art, right? Like when I think of Metal Slug, it's like the greatest looking pixel art in the world. And every time I see a screenshot or a little clip of this game, it looks gorgeous.
It really is, man. They've got all the stuff. And, you know, you remember like the mummies from Metal, they're in this, and you can get turned into a mummy, and then you have like different abilities when you're in the mummy. It's like you're not dead. You're you have mummy abilities for a little while. It's like they you know, and all obviously the actual metal slugs, the tanks and stuff are all in the game. Like all of the references, if you dig this franchise, they've really mined it for some really fun stuff. And I think this is like a top tier effort across the board. It could have been just sort of mining nostalgia and kind of a rote tactics game or whatever. But I think they've really added a layer of innovation and thought that they could have gotten by without, but elevates this game to something even more special than just, I love Metal Slug and look how cool it looks to be able to play Metal Slug as a tactics game. It does more than just that. And I appreciate that about it.
Yeah, cool. I thought it was just, hey, do you remember Metal Slug? You do? Great. That means you're old. Mm-hmm. That means your reflexes aren't what they used to be. Yeah. So we're giving you a tactics
slow
game.
All this down for you.
There you go.
Yeah, I really enjoy this game. So high recommendation from me, Metal Slug Tactics. All right, let's talk. Mike is a champion of one particular tabletop game. And I had a whole weekend playing a ton of tabletop games. I probably won't get to all of them. But let's carve out a little bit of tabletop time. Right now. Mike, I know that you are a huge fan of the Disney card game Lorcana.
Yes.
As a Disney fan, somebody who makes a Disney podcast. Lorcana is a huge hit, and I know a lot of people love it. Tell me why you like it. Well, there you go. He's got a card right there.
Actually, because it's a Disney card game, right? How can I not? you mentioned I love Disney, right? It is kind of one of my things. Video games, Disney, that's a lot of the makeup of a Mike Minotti. So in this card game is a big celebration of specifically Disney feature animation, like not even Pixar, not Marvel. Not Star Wars, just like the straight Disney animation canon. So, you know, like everything from Snow White to kind of newer stuff like Raya and Last Dragon and Moana is represented in this card game. This base is kind of like Magic the Gathering with its own certain twists and whatnot. It's a fun game to play. It really is. And I play it with my brother sometimes, who are also terrible Disney adults. But it really is the collecting, right? I do like that. Like each time there's an expansion set, you can buy these treasure troves, they're called, which comes with these nice little boxes. So you can put all of your cards in here and you get 8 packs just when you do that. You know, they do the obscure movies too. Like there's a lot of Treasure Planet cards, and you have to be a bit of a disgusting Disney adult to still care about Treasure Planet or Atlantis, the Lost Empire, or the Great Mouse Detective from the 80s, things like that. So it really is a card game kind of made for the hardcore Disney freak in a lot of ways, but it's something that you could introduce to other people and they will enjoy playing it. If you have any affinity for those Disney feature animated movies and you like Magic the Gathering or you're a Pokemon card fan or something like that, I think it's something worth looking into. I have a lot of fun just collecting these things. I wish there was like a mobile or desktop app, because the other game I'm playing a lot right now is that new Pokemon mobile card game, which is super fun. And it's just, card games are way easier when they're digitized. They just are. You don't have to like argue over the rules. The game just tells you what the rules are. But still, I like it a lot for what it is right now.
I'm surprised they haven't come out. I feel like it's just a matter of time and before this hits an app. But they probably want to juice the physical sales as long as they can before that happens. But man, I've talked to folks that really dig this game, and I was just at this kind of retreat that I go to with my buddies, and one of my friends gave me a couple of Lorcana packs. So I'm excited to dig into it and see what this game's all about. I'm glad to hear you like it a lot. So the playing of the game, you also dig, not just the collecting aspect?
Yeah, I do. And again, it's been a lot more of the collecting than the playing recently. Those two brothers that, you know, I would play with, they also have a lot of children and stuff, so they get busy sometimes.
Sure.
When we do play, we do have a lot of fun. But it is, you know, because, you know, there's like, there's a hall foil card and there's legendary cards, but then there's the super rare enchanted cards that have the full card art that goes out of the borders, right? And you get one of those, and then the dopamine really hits, right? then you're really happy for a little bit.
Well, one of the things that I played this weekend, I do this periodic weekend where I go and just play board games with my buddies, the old TRS guys, and I get together and a couple other friends, and we have this retreat where we just stay indoors for 4 days and play a bunch of board games. One of the things that I did there, since you brought up Lorcana, is I had never done this. I got into Magic pretty hard for a short period of time, but I haven't played Magic in quite a while, but one of my friends brought a bunch of Magic decks, and we played Magic in a way I had never played before. I know it has blown up, you know, Commander decks and Two-Headed Dragon, and a lot of these multiplayer versions of Magic are really taking hold. They're all over YouTube and people love them. I hadn't really played the full, you know, multiplayer version of Magic the Gathering. But man, we played they call it like the pentagram. We played, there was five of us. And it's like the two people across from you are your opponents, and the two people on either side of you are your allies. And that works in sort of a pentagram. So everybody's two people. So you have like one ally on your left with a shared enemy, and one ally on your right with a shared enemy. And everybody is like that, right?
Oh.
So you all are, you know, it works like a pentagram. And it was so much fun where you're teaming up but they have an ally who is your enemy, you know, so everybody you have an ally with also has an ally that is your enemy. So there's all this really interesting push and pull of who am I attacking? Okay, my ally, you know, set up my attack by attacking a target and making them tap a lot of their creatures for defense. And now I can swoop in, and now they don't have as much defense. So you have to sort of think that way and think about multiple people attacking you and how can my allies help? It was really fun. I had not played Magic like that before ever. And it's been a minute since I'd played Magic at all. And I was like, ooh, I see why this is getting so popular. This is really fun.
God, that sounds really interesting. Yeah. I've had like my kind of, like medium points of Magic. I never got super into it. Although when that Final Fantasy set comes out next year, I think I might have to dive in a bit more then, because there's some good looking cards there.
They're doing all these crazy team ups. It's pretty cool. So another game I want to talk about real quick. I won't talk about all the games that I played at this retreat, because there was a lot, and I'll talk about them over the coming weeks as opportunity arises. But one game I wanted to mention is called The Crew. There's multiple versions of The Crew, but The Crew Mission Deep Sea is the one I purchased and we played. And this is a cooperative trick-taking game. So if you've ever played, like, I think Hearts is a trick-taking game, classic trick-taking game. Trick-taking games means everybody plays a card, what they call a trick, and you have to follow suit. So you have to play the same suit of a card, but the highest value card in the right suit takes the trick. Hearts, spades, I know there's a bunch of other classic, like, Hoyles games that that use trick taking. The crew mission Deep Sea uses that same mechanism, but allows for some storytelling, which is cool, and really switches it up by making it a cooperative game. Because trick taking games, by their very nature, you tend to, you know, I took the trick, you didn't get it. Who got the most tricks wins the game.
They're backstabbing. They're all backstabbing games.
They're all backstabbing. Right.
Sweating people out. You know, it's all catchphrases and backstabbing. That's how you play Hearts.
That's right. Except the crew, we're all on the same team. And what happens is, so the theming of this game is all around, as you might expect, a submarine crew. So you're in a submarine. And there's flavor text that sets up each mission. And there's an entire book. There's the rule book, and there's a separate book of missions that have a bunch of flavor text that set up, you know, this kind of ongoing story, mission to mission as the story continues. It's nothing to write home about, but it's got some cool, fun stuff. And it adds context, so you're not just playing this kind of dry trick-taking game. Because most of the components of the crew mission Deep Sea are – just different colored cards in different, you know, different suits and numbers. So it really is mimicking just a kind of a standard deck of playing cards. But because it has the theming, you can kind of get into it. And what the game does that is unique is each of these missions will give you a difficulty level. And then you have this other deck of goal cards. So you draw goal cards, and each of the goal cards has a difficulty number on it. And then you see how difficult the mission is, and you draw goal cards until you've reached the difficulty number. So you add up the numbers on the goal cards until you reach the difficulty number. And so that means you can have one goal, three goals, five goals. It varies from mission to mission, and it varies depending on which ones you drew. So if you have, like, a difficulty level of five, you may get a three difficulty and a two difficulty, or you may get, you know, two ones, a two, and another two, you know, whatever it is. It's like, even playing it game to game, it's not always going to be the same, even if you're replaying the same mission. So that's cool. A lot of replayability there. And the goals are really nefarious. You have to win a certain trick and have this numbered card in it. You have to win a certain number of tricks. You have to win a trick using a specific value of a card, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you sort of draft these goals, so multiple people will have goals. And now everybody at the table is trying to make those goals happen. And the kicker is you can't talk to each other. Mm. So you're this crew of a submarine. You have no way – you're not allowed to discuss strategy. You are given a mechanism in the game that allows you to communicate one thing. So there's this cool little, like, sonar thing that lets you communicate one thing. So each person on the team can communicate one thing, and you have to sort of it's almost like a puzzle game where you're trying to figure out how we're going to be able to solve these goals before the ticking clock of running out of cards. Like, because you've only got a finite number of cards until you've played all your cards, and then if you haven't done your goals, you fail. I don't know if I've done a great job of explaining that.
No, sounds interesting. The way you're talking about, the way you have to talk to people, I'm like, wow, it's like playing an online Nintendo game, right?
That's right. That's right. It's a terrible communication system. We had so much fun with this game because you get to this situation where it's like, oh my gosh, this is impossible. But then you figure out ways to, like, flip things and trick things, and I've got this card in my hand that allows me to win the trick, and I'm holding on to it because I know I have to win a specific trick, but only when somebody else puts a specific card in. Oh, and now it's the time, and like surprising each other with what we had in store and what we were planning. What a cool game. This is a small box game. I think it's like $20 if that, but has tons of game inside this little box. The crew,
$15.
What?
$15 right now on their website.
It's great. It's great. I picked this up because a number of people I respect were saying that it was one of their favorite board games a few years ago when it came out, and I hadn't gotten around to playing it yet. And man, I really was surprised at how fun it was and how much the changing up of the goals every round. And then, you know, because it's got these missions, sometimes it'll throw real crazy wild cards at you, so to speak, where it'll be like, okay, now all communication is shut off. So even that little sonar thing that you're able to do, you can't do. Or it'll be like, now you have a time limit. And so it's like, put 3.5 minutes on your phone and count it down. You know, it's really clever the ways it keeps switching things up and making things more difficult and more interesting. And you know, you get into this pattern of, oh, we figured out a way to do this and this. Well, now doing that and that doesn't help you at all because you've got a completely different set of goals. You've got a completely different way of playing the game. And ultimately, it comes down to something that is very, very simple, which is this trick-taking mechanic that's been around forever and is so easy to learn. It's not complicated. You literally just play a single card. That's all you do. You play one card per trick, you know? So it's a really easy game to learn and fun for groups. And because you've got these missions, you know, you've kind of got almost a campaign that you're playing through. And the missions, you know, build on each other and the story unfolds over time. So it's called The Crew Mission Deep Sea, and I really dig it.
Is there a lot of failure, like fail states, because it's cooperative? Because in Hearts, I lose all the time, but yes, Someone at the table wins. Yes. And it sounds like a game might end often of you all dying,
yes,
or failing.
The scoring in the game is how many times it took you to do it.
Ah, okay.
So you get scored by how many, and then there's a certain thing where you can. One person is elected as the captain, or not elected, but based on a card you get in your hand, you become the captain of the submarine. Every round is a new captain, and that captain has a sort of a superpower that he can do or she can do that that allows you to sort of it's like you got an additional fail on your scorecard, but because you use this superpower that lets you. So there's like mitigating factors. If you're losing a lot, you can sort of do stuff. It's very, very smartly designed.
That's cool.
But simple, like so simple, you know, taking something that is a classical card game mechanic and not, you know, the cards themselves are like 1 through 9 of 4 different colors. There's nothing special about them. But what happens is so interesting and special. I'm just impressed with it.
That's old school Disney animation approach. You take this classic thing, everybody knows, nothing special about it, and then make something special out of it.
You're not wrong.
I appreciate you translating it for me. Thank you.
Well, I have a bunch of other games I could talk about, but we'll save those for future installments. We'll wrap this one up. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Mike Minotti, it's always so fun chatting with you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's always a good time. Really appreciate you reaching out to me. Always a good time talking about video games and everything else and whatnot.
We love it. We love it. Hey, tell folks where they can keep up with you and all the cool stuff that you're doing online.
Sure. On Twitter and Blue Sky now, which seems like more and more people are heading towards, as Tolkoto, TOLKOTO. I've been streaming a lot on Twitch these days, actually, under Tolkoto 2. Been having a lot of fun with that. Been playing a lot of Souls-likes and just whatever else catches my fancy. Contributing on Giant Bomb a lot and Managing Editor at GamesBeat. So check out everything going on there. And yeah, that 90s Disney, that's the podcast I do with my brothers, AJ and Chris, where we do specifically talk about Disney stuff from the 90s, theme park rides or movies or just anything else the company had its grubby little mitts in during that decade. So we always have a fun time with that. So yeah, if you do like Disney, check that one out, 90s Disney.
Wonderful. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
Well, for folks that might not know, we have been doing little short videos, usually two per week, that go up on our Instagram and YouTube. YouTube is at DLC Pod. Instagram is DLC Hype Train. And they're just about a minute long. We had a fun short two this past week about Nintendo stuff. I predicted when I think the Nintendo will, when Nintendo will announce the Switch successor. You talked a little bit about backwards compatibility. So those are fun little hot takes. If you need a little DLC to get you through the week, that other than the main show that is a video game related, those usually go up on Wednesdays and Fridays. Again, Instagram is at DLC Hype Train and YouTube is at DLC Pod. So we'll be having more of those come out. And then I write an occasional newsletter about video games that folks can subscribe to for free over on Substack, christianspicer.substack.com, one or two a month, and they're very conversational in nature. I like to engage with the community there, and I always do my best to reply to everybody who replies to me. The last one was about horror video games, what makes a video game horror, kind of inspired by a conversation we had, Jeff, about BioShock and that type of atmosphere and gameplay mechanics versus something like Silent Hill 2, both creepy atmospheres, but very different gameplay mechanics and what that might mean for horror video games. And again, folks can find that at christianspicer.substack.com.
Very cool. You can find me on socials at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. Of course, I do the film cast where we talk about movies and TV shows. Also, We Have Concerns, a comedy science show where you can learn something and laugh along the way, both of which available wherever you get fine podcasts. All right, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion of what to do this week. Give us a parting gift. This is your parting gift.
Mike, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned earlier how I do like to listen to audiobooks as I'm going to sleep, and I usually pick kind of nonfiction things, science or history related. One I did really enjoy recently is called The Innovators. That's by Walter Isaacson. Isaacson's done some of those big kind of tech people biographies. He did that big one on Steve Jobs, right? That came out right around when he passed. This one's neat because it's more of a general overview of the history of computers. As much time as I spend with computers and on computers, I'm like, I don't know very much about them. I don't know where these things really came from. So this was great. It sort of starts very early with like Lady Lovelace and Babbage in the 1800s with like that very general idea of what a computer could be. And then you get through to other big figures like Turing. Eventually make your way to like your Steve Wozniaks, your Bill Gates, and even Steve Jobs, going kind of all the way up to relatively modern times, you know, with more recent developments. But yeah, it was a very good overview of just the history of computers, you know, just even learning about like, you know, although that's where routers came from. Okay, that's good to know. And well, cool. That's why we have the internet now. Okay, that's who paid for that. Apparently, Xerox, the copier company, yeah. They had a lot to do Xerox with Park. Researching. Yep, exactly. Yeah. I learned a lot about Alto Balto and stuff like that or whatever. I probably just said it wrong. But yeah, so it was a good crash course for me. I didn't know much, and now I know a little bit.
And that's due to The Innovators by Walter Isaacson, Mike Minotti's parting gift. Christian Spicer, what is your parting gift?
Mine is local for folks and also only specific for only some of our audience. And that is to engage with your PTA or whatever it might be called at your kid's school if you have a kid in school.
Paul Thomas Anderson?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is. The movies that they're filming at your kid's school. It's very LA specific, I should have said. Yeah. Sorry. No, the PTA... bringing parents and teachers together to make the school a better place. We talk about it at the end of, Jeff says at the end of every episode, making the world a better place. And I think it is a thing that we all probably get a million emails about and we are all too busy to engage with, but there are great people. You probably are already a member of yours at your school, because you probably were like, oh, you checked the box and you paid $7 or you know, whatever it was to become. But I would encourage you, if you have school age children, to get involved in however parents can get involved at the school. I think the PTA is a great way to do that. You get to meet people. You get to meet the principal and the teachers in a way that's different than the way you engage with them once or twice a year at parent teacher night or back to school night or something like that. And you get to be involved in what the school is doing in a meaningful way, field trips, activities, speakers they're bringing in. And it is a way that you can make a real difference on not only your child's life, but all of the kids in that school, and to help make the world a better place. So while we are all inundated with a million emails and we all have a bazillion things to do in our busy lives, I would encourage you to find a way to be involved at your child's school in a way that can help make the world a better place. And I find doing that is by joining and participating in the PTA at my kid's school.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. My parting gift is a similar sort of lifey thing. I had a hard week. I'm sure some people can relate to that. I was so fortunate that just by pure happenstance, the one weekend that worked out for my friends and I to go away and meet up in a little room and play board games for a couple of days happened to be this last weekend. The end of a very trying and frustrating week for me. And I got to say, man, it filled up my soul. It filled my soul. I have a group of buddies and we periodically go, we happen to go to Palm Springs and just stay in a little Airbnb that my friend's family has access to. And just play board games, just sit in the room, eat good food, like order food and sit there and laugh and play. And man, being in the same, I love playing online. I love the fact that our technological lives allow us to be able to do things like this right now, where the three of us are all in different states in our country and we're able to hang out. But man, being in the same room with friends and laughing and just, you know, my friend likes to say laughing and scratching, hanging out and not having an agenda and doing nothing except, you know, playing some board games and chatting and catching up. It did wonders for my well-being, my soul, my whatever you want to call it. It's exactly what I needed. And I just, I recommend it. Excuse me. If you can manage to get in the same physical location and try to have just go to a place that none of you live and hang out, play some board games, do whatever it is that you like to do. Do it with people that you love. You know, they might not even be your family. Just make you laugh. It's a salve for what ails me. At least it was for me. All right. We got a listener-suggested parting gift. This comes to us from Michael. He sent it to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Michael says, I love the show, guys. I've been listening since the beginning. And before that, since Weekend Confirmed. And before that, since the One Up Yours podcast. Which, you know, I was only on a few times. But I appreciate it. It's more of a Garnett thing. Which brings me to my gift, my parting gift, the Electronic Gaming Monthly Compendium Kickstarter, which ends November 14th. So tick-tock, as you hear this, probably only got a few days if you're listening to this right when it drops. For readers as old as me, Michael continues, they probably have fond memories of the days of print gaming mags, and EGM is likely one of your faves. With its talented group of editors that are basically the forefathers of the video game podcasts I listen to today. The Kickstarter looks to compile a fancy 300-plus page book about the entire run, as well as create a complete searchable archive of the entire 25-year print run of the magazine. Needless to say, I'm very excited to revisit some of my oldest friends in the form of editorials and features and reviews. So for anyone else with a similar nostalgic memory for the good old days, I suggest they check it out. Hopefully more projects like this will follow for other beloved gaming mags of yesteryear. Keep up the great work, Michael.
It's funny that this is mentioned here. I'm actually contributing to this book project. EGM was incredibly important to me. It was, you know, formative in my interest for gaming. One up yours. I was a giant fan of that. I was on those message boards. I was writing in. That was the podcast I was a big fanboy of back in the day. And then I got my start in games media when kind of ex-EGM and 1UP people like Dan Chu and Damian Lin started a site called bitmob.com. So that's where I started. So I really do trace kind of my roots in all of this back to EGM. So being a part of this project is a really big honor for me. I'm very excited about it.
Wow. That's so cool. And I love that this is happening. I'm sure it was no easy feat to get the rights to be able to even do it at all. It is really, really cool. And it does feel like a shared history that those of us of a certain age all recall how much those magazines meant to us. So thank you, Michael, for sending that in. And thanks, Mike, for contributing. I can't wait to see what your section of this project is. It's really exciting.
It's going to be fun.
If you'd like to have your parting gift on our show, send it to us. DLCfeedback@gmail.com is where you do that. All right. Thanks again. We really appreciate you listening. That's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Got to thank Mike Minotti and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Got to thank our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. Of course, if you'd like to purchase merchandise around the show, you can do that at our store, which is store.dlcpod.com. And the biggest thanks always are for our patrons, without whom we would not be doing this. So thank you, patrons, for supporting the show. If you'd like to become one, check out all the cool stuff you can get in exchange by visiting patreon.com/dlcpod. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.